From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Without a flag, we cannot sail. But this is not the end. Israel cannot and will not crush our resolve to break its illegal siege and reach the people of Gaza.
As the death toll in Gaza nears 35,000, Israel again blocks life-saving aid. We'll speak with Huwaida Araf, one of hundreds of activists aboard the Freedom Flotilla, who've been held back in Turkey after Guinea-Bissau withdrew its flagships under pressure from Israel. We'll also speak with Israeli-American author Ayelet Waldman and U.S. Rabbi Alyssa Wise. They were among seven arrested by Israeli police Friday at the Gaza border while trying to bring food into Gaza and accusing Israel of using starvation as a weapon of war against Palestinians.
The reason we came all the way across the world is because the crisis is at a scale that's unimaginable, and we can't simply stay where we are and not try to do what we can, however we can, to bring attention to this crisis and to stop this crisis.
And we'll look at a new sci-fi documentary about the once thriving Palestinian city of Lod that presents an alternate reality in which the residents were not expelled in the Nakba in 1948.
We use the story of Lod to symbolize the story of the Nakba, the Palestinian Nakba, the demolition and expulsion of over 600 villages all across Palestine. So in a way, the story of Lod is the story of Palestine.
We'll speak with the Palestinian filmmaker originally from Lod and his co-director, an American Jewish director. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's in Saudi Arabia, while Hamas has sent negotiators to Cairo as talks continue over a ceasefire in Gaza and the release of more hostages. On Sunday, President Biden spoke by phone with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. On Saturday, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas called on the U.S. to halt Israel's planned attack on Rafah.
We hope that Israel stops doing this attack, and we call on the United States of America to ask Israel to not carry on this Rafah attack, because America is the only country able to prevent Israel from committing this crime.
Over the weekend, Israel repeatedly bombed areas of Rafah. In one attack, Israel killed nine members of the same family, including a baby. On Friday, an Israeli airstrike on Gaza City killed the daughter and grandson of the prominent Palestinian poet Rafat Al-Arir, who was killed in an Israeli airstrike in December. Shaima Rafat Al-Arir died Friday, along with her husband and two-month-old son. Shaima had recently written a message on Facebook addressed to her late father, writing, quote, "I have a beautiful news for you. I wish I could convey it to you while you are in front of me. I present to you your first grandchild. Do you know, my father, that you have become a grandfather? This is your grandson, Abdurrahman, whom I have long imagined you carrying, but I never imagined that I would lose you early, even before you see him," she wrote. The website Electronic Intifada reports Shaima Rafat Al-Arir and her family were killed while sheltering in the building of Global Communities, an international relief charity. Police across the United States made at least 275 arrests over the weekend as campus protests against Israel's assault on Gaza continue to spread. In Boston, police detained about 100 people after students set up a Palestine solidarity encampment on the campus of Northeastern University. The school justified the raid, citing what it called virulent anti-Semitic slurs after someone chanted, "Kill the Jews," at the encampment. But video and eyewitness testimony revealed the anti-Semitic chant was actually done by a counter-protester holding an Israeli flag. The group Huskies for a Free Palestine said, quote, the only people hurling anti-Semitic slurs last night were Zionist counter-protesters attempting to instigate our peaceful encampment. Despite this, the university exploited this moment to lie about our encampment and justify the brutal arrest of over 100 students, they said. In St. Louis, police arrested more than 80 people at a pro-Palestine encampment at Washington University. The arrested included Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein. At Arizona State University, police made around 70 arrests on Friday as they broke up an encampment on Alumni Lawn. At Indiana State University, state police arrested 33 people Friday as they broke up an encampment on the Bloomington campus. Despite the police crackdown, campus encampments continue to spread, including at CUNY, the City University of New York.
Today, we have an encampment in City College, City University of New York, and we are demanding that CUNY divests and be transparent with the investment. And we are demanding that students, workers of CUNY cannot be harassed, cannot be doxxed for standing up for Palestine.
On Saturday, protesters rallied outside the White House Correspondents Association dinner in Washington, D.C. Protesters staged a die-in to honor the more than 140 journalists killed in Gaza during Israel's assault. Protesters screamed, "Shame on you," as journalists dressed in black tie attire entered the Washington Hilton. Code Pink co-founder Medea Benjamin was violently thrown out of the hotel as she attempted to hold up a sign reading, 100 members of the press killed in Gaza.
I was standing here quietly with this sign and got so roughed up by the security and thrown out of the hotel. It's quite ironic because tonight was all about press. Standing here with the sign is something that's a lot worse than 100 journalists in Gaza being killed.
During his remarks at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, President Biden made no mention of Gaza, but he repeatedly criticized Donald Trump, who he called Sleepy Don, after the former president repeatedly fell asleep during his criminal trial in New York. The U.S. State Department's decided against placing sanctions on the Israeli military despite a finding that three Israeli units had committed, quote, gross human rights violations, unquote, against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank prior to October 7th. Last week, there were press reports that the Biden administration was preparing to impose sanctions on Netzeh Yehuda, an ultra-Orthodox Jewish battalion. But the administration has since reversed course. In other State Department news, Reuters is reporting some senior officials within the department have advised Secretary of State Blinken that Israel's not using U.S.-supplied weapons in accordance with international law. In a memo to Blinken, the officials cite the, quote, unconscionably high levels of civilian harm and Israel's, quote, killing humanitarian workers and journalists at an unprecedented rate, unquote. In related news, the New York Times reports the Israeli government fears the International Criminal Court may soon issue arrest warrants for senior Israeli officials, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, over the war on Gaza and for Israel's blocking of humanitarian aid. Hamas officials could also face ICC arrest warrants over the attack on October 7th. Meanwhile, Israeli authorities arrested seven people, including a number of rabbis and Jewish American peace activists who tried to bring aid into Gaza on Friday. We'll speak with the Israeli American author Ayelet Waldman and Rabbi Alyssa Wise. Both were arrested Friday on the Gaza border. Plans for a Freedom Flotilla to sail from Turkey to Gaza with 5,000 tons of life-saving aid have stalled after Guinea-Bissau decided to remove its flag from two of the vessels on the flotilla following pressure from Israel. We'll speak with an organizer of the flotilla after headlines. Ukrainian troops have begun retreating from several villages in eastern Ukraine as Russia intensifies its attacks while Ukraine waits for a new shipment of arms from the United States. Over the weekend, Russian forces reportedly captured two villages in the Donetsk region. Russia has also ramped up attacks on Ukraine's railroad station, attempt to disrupt weapons supply routes. In political news, Arizona Republicans have named an accused fake elector for Donald Trump as a National Committee member for the Republican National Committee. Arizona State Senator Jake Hoffman was indicted last week with 17 others in the plot to overturn President Biden's 2020 win in Arizona. The Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigations launched a probe into the recent death of Frank Tyson, a 53-year-old black man who died after police pinned him to the ground inside a bar. Body cam video shows Tyson repeatedly said, "I can't breathe," but officers ignored his pleas as he lost consciousness. The body cam video shows police waited 5 minutes to check for his pulse, then another 3 minutes before CPR was started. One officer is heard joking, saying, quote, "I've always wanted to be in a bar fight. I don't know if this counts." Unquote. Frank Tyson died just 12 days after being released from 24 years in prison. In Colorado, former paramedic Jeremy Cooper has been sentenced to 4 years of probation with 14 months of work release after he was found guilty of criminally negligent homicide in the 2019 death of Elijah McClain. The 23-year-old black man who was walking home from the store when he was tackled by police, placed in a carotid hold, and later injected with ketamine. In March, another paramedic, Peter Kuchiniak, was sentenced to 5 years in prison for his role in McClain's death. And in Australia, thousands of people took to the streets in nationwide protests demanding an end to gender-based violence. The rallies come amidst a wave of violent crimes against women, including a mass stabbing in Sydney earlier this month, where 5 out of the 6 fatal victims were women. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese addressed the crowd, calling the situation a national crisis and an epidemic. This is Natalie, one of the demonstrators.
I think the government needs to declare this devastating thing that's happening to women as a national emergency. Enough women have died, 26, and it's really, really upsetting. I think we're human. We shouldn't be getting killed.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the official death toll in Gaza nears 35,000, ceasefire talks are continuing this week with Hamas officials in Cairo, Egypt, and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Saudi Arabia before he heads to Jordan and Israel. Meanwhile, Israel's military's chief of staff has approved the continuation of war, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has refused to call off the expected ground invasion of Rafah. This comes as the International Criminal Court could reportedly issue arrest warrants for senior Israeli officials, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, over the war on Gaza and for Israel's blocking of humanitarian aid. Israel's also targeted humanitarian workers in deadly attacks. Hundreds of aid workers have been killed by Israel since October 7th, including 7 members of the international organization World Central Kitchen, which is resuming food distribution in Gaza today, nearly 4 weeks after its convoy came under attack. Amidst the mounting humanitarian disaster in Gaza, hundreds of activists aboard the Freedom Flotilla were blocked in Turkey Saturday as they attempted to set sail for the besieged Palestinian territory. Organizers say Guinea-Bissau withdrew its flagships under pressure from Israel but vowed to overcome this latest challenge. A group of UN experts called for safe passage of the vessels, writing, quote, "The flotilla is a material manifestation of international support for the ongoing Palestinian struggle for freedom and self-determination, and the internationally recognized right to receive humanitarian aid without interference or hindrance. Support for the Palestinian people's human rights is acute under the current conditions of genocide, domicide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity," they said. For more, we're joined in Istanbul by Huwaida Araf, Palestinian-American human rights attorney, organizer with the Gaza Freedom Flotilla. She was also part of the 2010 Gaza Freedom Flotilla, which Israel attacked, killing 10 activists on the Mavi Marmara. Welcome to Democracy Now! Again, Huwaida. If you can talk about what this Freedom Flotilla is and the obstacles it has faced leaving Turkey.
Thank you. It's good to be with you, Amy. The Freedom Flotilla is a continuation of the effort of the Freedom Flotilla Coalition to confront and challenge and indeed break Israel's unlawful siege on Gaza. It has been in place since 2007. It is a form of collective punishment, which is not only unlawful, it is a war crime, and yet our governments have not been doing anything about it. And in fact, the very fact that for decades our governments have been allowing Israel impunity is what has brought us to this point where Israel for 7 months can commit live stream genocide and the world doesn't move. The world, meaning our governments, of course, people are mobilizing, but we're not stopping it because Israel is so used to this impunity. We come together, the Freedom Flotilla Coalition, and announce that we are going to sail an emergency flotilla in light of the dire situation in Gaza, which includes mass starvation and now famine that has set in. Again, war crimes, but our governments aren't doing anything about it. What do they do? Pay lip service to Palestinian human rights, airdrop food, or talk about a maritime corridor which leaves Israel in control of what, if any, aid at all gets to a people trying to survive a genocide. It's absolutely obnoxious. And one of the things that the UN Special Rapporteurs that you mentioned in their statement said that our Freedom Flotilla is legitimately challenging Israel's control over the entry of aid, which no government is doing. And that's what needs to be done. How can we be in a state where a country that has been found to be plausibly committing a genocide by the world court is allowed to control what, if any, aid gets to a people trying to survive a genocide? It is unconscionable. And so we have come together. We are now and have been in Istanbul, Turkey. We have ships ready to go. We have one cargo ship loaded with over 5,000 tons of humanitarian aid, largely food, clean water, medicines, baby formula, nutrition for children, diapers. That was all ready to go. Hundreds of activists from 40 countries were here knowing that Israel has killed activists before in such a mission and yet still willing to risk it to do what no government has done. And yet, instead of our governments supporting our efforts, they have conspired to actually block us. And so what happened on Friday is we received a surprise communique from the Guinea-Bissau International Ship Registry saying that they have withdrawn their flag from two of our ships, the cargo ship and the main passenger vessel. Now, we cannot sail without a flag. It was clear to us that the withdrawal of this flag was under pressure, likely from the United States and Israel, because the way that they communicated to us was highly unusual, if not unprecedented. In their communication to us, they specifically referenced our trip to Gaza, and they had demanded from us a number of things which were impossible to meet in the two-hour time frame that they gave us, which some of those things included a complete manifesto of our cargo, all of the ports we were going to sail in, a letter from the receiving port where we were going to arrive saying that our arrival and carry of humanitarian aid is welcome. They gave us a two-hour window. This is never done. It's like when you go to register your car, you know, at the DMV, they don't ask you everywhere you're going and who is going to be in your car. I don't know of a situation where this has been done before. And yet, because we did not meet these and were not able to submit all of this information within a two-hour window, they informed us that our flag has been withdrawn. This is not the end.
What made you believe that Israel put,
and politically?
What made you believe that Israel had put pressure on Guinea-Bissau to remove its flags?
Again, because the demands that they made of us, specifically referencing our planned trip to confront Israel's siege and our intent to arrive in Gaza, and giving us a two-hour window to submit all of this documentation about our journey, and knowing that Israel has done this before. It has tried all kinds of methods in order to sabotage our missions. It has sabotaged our boats before. It has attempted to get various, and succeeded in getting various countries to block us from leaving port, and it was being reported that the United States specifically was putting pressure on Turkey, the government here, to block us from leaving. But we were sure we were going to be able to leave from Turkey because the support here is so great. So Israel has tried all of these efforts. It actually boasts about these efforts. But if Israel thinks that this is the end of our effort to break the unlawful siege of Gaza, they are sadly mistaken. A lot of the activists who were here are fired up. They are determined. They are going back home at this point until we can reflag our ships, which hopefully will be in the coming weeks, and coming back with even more people and more determination. So this is a minor setback, but it's certainly not the end. And we will not.
We will not stop
in our efforts to break this siege.
If you can tell us who the activists are, the doctors, the nurses, the lawyers who are on board this ship.
I would love to. They are amazing people from all over the world who have left their families, who have left their jobs, who have left the comforts of their own home to undertake a mission where we could not guarantee their safety. So we've had doctors coming from as far as New Zealand. We've had activists from South Africa. We had truck drivers from Ireland. We have mental health and social workers from the United States, students, professors, retired U.S. military, retired U.S. like active combat, former FBI agents. We had parliamentarians, the former mayor of Barcelona, European parliamentarians, Algerian and Jordanian parliamentarians, really a cross-section of humanity that is sick and tired of our governments allowing the ongoing persecution and now genocide of the Palestinian people. And we are determined to stop this by direct action, which is, of course, goes along with all of the other efforts that have been taking place all around the world. And we also want to send our respect, admiration, and solidarity with the student movement across the United States and now spreading across the world. This is what's needed. We are going to bring about the change. Our governments have sadly failed. They only pay lip service to democracy, freedom, and human rights.
Among the high-profile activists that are part of the Freedom Flotilla is Nkosi Mandela Mandela, South African member of parliament and the grandson of Nelson Mandela. He spoke to Al Jazeera last week.
I am a living example of the efforts of the international solidarity movement. I am free. South Africa is free. We were able to defeat apartheid South Africa because of the support that we had from the international community. And therefore, we want to thank them for taking this stand and for ensuring that they will not be complicit, they will no longer be silent, they will be the voice for the Palestinians.
Now, in the summer of 2010, the Israeli military attacked a Gaza Freedom Flotilla, killing 10 people, including an American citizen. It was the Mavi Marmara that they attacked, the ship. The Vice President, Joe Biden, defended the raid in an interview on PBS shortly afterward.
You can argue whether Israel should have dropped people onto that ship or not, in the right, but the truth of the matter is Israel has a right to know. They're at war with Hamas, has a right to know whether or not arms are being smuggled in. And up to now, Charlie, what's happened? They've said, here you go. You're in the Mediterranean. This ship, if you divert slightly north, you can unload it and we'll get the stuff into Gaza. So what's the big deal here? What's the big deal of insisting it go straight to Gaza?
President Joe Biden in 2010. Wait, Araf, this shows the stakes. 10 people were killed, yet you're willing to go on this ship to try to challenge the Gaza blockade. As we wrap up, you have 30 seconds. Talk about that risk.
Yeah, first of all, I need to say that Joe Biden's absolutely mistaken. Israel has no right, had no right to intercept and attack our ships because it has no right to place the Palestinian people under collective punishment. Again, it is a war crime, and a UN panel, an independent investigation, found the very same thing. Amy, it's a sad thing that people, it has to be a life or death situation to deliver food to people who are being deliberately starved. But that is what we have here because our governments have continued to allow Israel to do this. I left my two kids at home, and I promised them that I would come back. I know they need their mother, and I hoped to be able to fulfill my promise to come back, but I didn't know. I don't know. But what I do know is that I can't leave to them a world where this can happen, where people can be slaughtered for months on end, oppressed for years, and the world does nothing. So my action here, and a lot of the activists that have joined us, and the many, many more who want to join us now, are do it with the same conviction that we have to act to change the world that we want to live in and that we want to pass on to generations to come, and we are willing to risk our lives to do that.
Yoda, Palestinian-American human rights attorney, one of the organizers of the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, speaking to us from Istanbul, Turkey. Next up, we speak with two women, an Israeli-American author, Ayelet Waldman, and the U.S. rabbi, Alyssa Wise. They were among seven arrested by Israeli police Friday as they attempted to get aid over the Gaza border, accusing Israel of using starvation as a weapon of war. Stay with us. Take Me to Palestine by El Fanoun, Palestinian popular dance troupe. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli police arrested seven rabbis and Israeli activists Friday at the Gaza border during an action that accused Israel of using starvation as a weapon of war against Palestinians. The delegation of rabbis for ceasefire carried bags of food to the Erez crossing between Israel and northern Gaza amidst reports that famine's imminent for more than a million Palestinians in Gaza. Among those who were joining the protests was Rabbi Abi Dabush, who is a survivor of the October 7th Hamas attack on Kibbutz Nirim.
I'm really proud of it. Being here in the name of Jewish values, being here in the name of Jewish discourse and the Torah, and talking about human rights for all people here. Of course, I can't forget the Israelis. I was in Kibbutz Nirim on October 7th, and can't forget the hostages. But then again, I can't forget also our people, you know, human beings in Gaza that are starving, got killed by thousands, and have devastating ruins.
For more, we're joined by Rabbi Alyssa Wise. She's now in Philadelphia after her release and return to the United States, founder and organizer with Rabbis for Ceasefire, former co-executive director of Jewish Voice for Peace, where she was also the founding co-chair of JVP's Rabbinical Council. She's now back in Philadelphia. And joining us from Tel Aviv is Ayelet Waldman, the Israeli-American novelist and writer who was arrested alongside Rabbi Wise and six others. Her husband, Michael Shaban, is also the noted novelist, the Pulitzer Prize winner, who expressed deep concern about Ayelet's status on Instagram, writing, "She was there in the company of a group of American rabbis, Rabbis for Ceasefire, to show the world, the people of Gaza, and their fellow Jews in Israel and around the world that Judaism teaches justice, loving kindness, peace, mercy, liberation," Shaban wrote. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Why don't we start with Ayelet Waldman, the noted Israeli-American author, novelist, in Tel Aviv right now. Ayelet, why did you go to the Eretz Crossing? Explain what it is and what happened.
The Eretz Crossing is the crossing in before the latest calamity where you could cross in and out of Gaza, of course, very restricted. Now it is something else entirely. We approached the Erez crossing as close as we could get, but obviously it's blocked off. Why I went, I think it is incredibly important that those of us who have privilege use that privilege to call attention to this ongoing catastrophe. So I want to be very clear. My husband was worried about me. It's sweet. I had an uncomfortable 9.5 hours. I had a mildly unpleasant 9.5 hours. When a Palestinian here is arrested and goes into one of the many military prisons, their experience is horrible. They can be held without charges. There are children who are held without charges. When an Israeli Jewish activist, they have been arrested over and over again. They put their bodies on the line. They put their reputations on the line in terms of their community. What we experienced was very minor, but I think I can only speak for myself to say that it felt critical to me to use whatever small platform I have to draw attention to this crisis and to say that as a human being and as a human being born in this country, I have to use my voice to say that this kind of horrific violence, this starving of children, this mass bombing is completely unacceptable. It is not just unjust, it's horrific. And I don't deny that what happened on October 7th was an atrocity. It broke my heart. I don't deny that what's being experienced by the Israeli hostages now in Gaza is horrible. Truly horrible. And my heart breaks for the families of the hostages. But we are seeing right now the mass starvation of an entire people. We are seeing an area where millions lived being reduced to dust. And people of good conscience simply cannot stand by and ignore or, cluck our teeth and say, it's really a shame, but Hamas, they're so terrible. Yeah, they're terrible, but it doesn't matter. And right now, what matters is stopping the starvation and the murder of millions of people in Gaza.
I want to bring Rabbi Alyssa Wise into this conversation. You've just left the Erez border crossing, and you're now in Philadelphia. You're founder of Rabbis for Ceasefire. Talk about why you went there. Israel has said they were opening that border to get aid in.
Yeah. So we came during the holiday of Passover, which is actually ending today and tomorrow. Passover is known as Zman Cherutenu, the season of our freedom. And if that is going to mean anything, it must mean that we work for the freedom of all people. It doesn't work that one people is free and another is captive. And Israel has, as your other guests have highlighted, is enacting a siege on the people of Gaza, where now people are on the verge of death through a policy of forced starvation that is in the wake of decades of an Israeli policy of forced displacement, occupation, apartheid, and Nakba, catastrophe that began in 1948. So for us as rabbis, when we came to think about what are we going to do this Pesach and this Passover, when we know that so many Jews are struggling with what does it mean to sit around a table and celebrate freedom when in our names a forced starvation and a mass murder is taking place. And it felt critical to us that we do literally whatever we possibly could to support the people of Gaza. So we came to the Erez crossing, and as we marched towards it, we chanted the words that begin the Magid section of the Passover Seder, which is the time in the Passover Seder where we tell the story of our people's liberation. And it begins with Kol Dichvin Yitei Ve'yichol. Let all who are hungry come and eat. And what does our tradition mean if not our ability and our mandate to speak out against Israel, a state that is speaking in our name? And I think it's doubly important because it kind of betrays the lie that Israel is a Jewish state. Israel is a state that is acting in its own interest that has actually nothing to do with Jewish tradition or Jewish values. Jewish values teach that all people are made B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of the divine. And this is not how you treat the divine.
Can you explain why you were arrested on Friday at the Erez border crossing?
So when we got to the crossing, you know, we anticipated that we would be stopped, but it felt urgent that we try. So we were at the border, and the police, you know, were insistent on pushing us back. You know, they actually did physically push us. And, you know, to us, American activists, it felt really intense and violent. And later, some of the veteran Israeli activists that were with us were like, oh, they were actually being really light with you. And we're like, wow, I can't imagine what it looks like. You know, for them to be even more violent. So, you know, they were insisting that we were in a closed military zone, which is, you know, we were freely walking down the road. So it wasn't, there was nothing visible up at where we were that we were in a closed military zone, though I know from other years of activism on the West Bank that that's often what they say is this is a closed military zone and you can't enter. And so they began arresting us and then forcibly removing everyone else who had come. So we had parked our cars down the road and attempted to go on foot. They pushed everybody back to their cars. So, you know, then we were taken to two different police stations. And Ayelet and I and another rabbi were held for 9.5 hours. During which we each kind of underwent an interrogation. And actually, when I sat down for my interrogation, the police officer said to me, you know, you're being detained here because you tried to bring food to the people of Gaza.
It's particularly interesting, Ayelet Waldman, that Rabbi Avi Dabush was there. He survived the Hamas attack on his kibbutz. He's executive director of Rabbis for Human Rights. If you can talk about that, and then before we end, talk not only about what's happening in Gaza and why you were trying to get aid there, but what is less reported, and that is what is happening in the West Bank. Ayelet Waldman.
Hi. One of the things that is important to know, I think, is that the kibbutzim that were on the south in what they call the Gaza envelope, the area of Israel that surrounds Gaza, many of the people in those kibbutzim were leftists. Many of them did things like escort people from Gaza to medical facilities in Israel. They worked, you know, Vivian Silver is someone that many of you know, a woman who devoted herself to coexistence, to peace. So many people who were attacked. And again, I will not deny the brutality and the horror of those attacks. They were themselves people who had worked for peace. But what I think is boggles my mind, and I hope that I would have the personal courage, is when you see someone like the rabbi, someone like the siblings of people who were killed, holding true to their values, managing to keep their compasses pointed true north, and to say that what happened to me and what happened to my people is not a reason for the kind of revenge that we are seeing now, and that revenge does not end in anything other than more revenge and this horrific cycle of violence. You know, one of the reasons that I did what I did, which again, I want to keep saying how small it is compared to what this flotilla was bringing, compared to what the Palestinian activists go through every day, compared to what the Israeli Jewish activists go through every day. But still, one of the reasons that I did what I did, and I can't speak for Rabbi Alyssa, but is because I wanted to show the people who I love, Palestinians in the West Bank who I know, that they are not alone. And it is so important to understand that weapons provided by American money have been distributed to settlers in the West Bank. Now, settlements in the West Bank are in violation of international law, all of them. If you were to look at a settlement, it would look to you like a beautiful town in Orange County, California. That is an illegal settlement. They are also fringe outposts that are, you know, even more, these are actually in violation of Israeli law, though you wouldn't note that because they are protected by the Israeli government. And so these settlers have been issued even more weapons than they already have. Many of them are now wearing uniforms, military uniforms, and they're carrying out a series of attacks on Palestinian individuals and communities in the West Bank. So, for example, small is Palestinian towns. People have been pushed out of their towns. People have been killed. People have been abused. People have been beaten up. And all eyes are on Gaza, as they should be. But the oppression and the violence being experienced by the Palestinians in the West Bank has not just continued, but it has been, the volume of it has been turned up immeasurably. And I think it's critically important that we do not forget these people. And, you know, I just want to say, like, I want to tell one almost ridiculous story.
We have 30 seconds.
30 seconds. There's a village, and this is happening all over the Hebron Hills. There's a village with, you know, shepherds, Palestinian shepherds. And what do the settlers do? They go, they take pictures of the sheep, and then they go to the police, the Israeli police, and they say, they stole our sheep, and look, I have a picture of my sheep. And then the Israeli police go and they steal the shepherd's sheep and give it to the settlers. I mean, think about that. The ridiculousness of stealing. And these are people who live hand to mouth. They live on the cheese they make from the milk they get from these sheep. And we're seeing people being murdered, and we're seeing people whose livelihoods are being stolen, and they're even taking their animals. I mean, that's the kind of absurdity that's going on under cover of darkness while eyes are on the horror of Gaza.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Ayelet Waldman is an Israeli-American novelist and writer. Among her books, the series The Mommy Track Mysteries, as well as her autobiographical essays about motherhood. She's speaking to us from Tel Aviv. And Rabbi Alyssa Wise is founder and organizer with Rabbis for Ceasefire. She's just back in Philadelphia. Both were arrested along with five others at the Erez Crossing trying to get food into Gaza. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, a new sci-fi documentary depicts the Palestinian city of Lod, both with and without the Nakba in 1948. Sounds puzzling? Stay tuned.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome one day. Deep in my heart, I do believe that we shall overcome one day.
Roger Waters performing We Shall Overcome in our Democracy Now! Studios in 2016, accompanied by, at the time, the high school cellist Alexander Rowatin. Waters is one of the executive producers of the film we're going to be talking about, Lod. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with a new film about the once-thriving Palestinian city of Lod. It's a science fiction documentary that depicts the Palestinian city both with and without the Nakba in 1948, when over 750,000 Palestinians were driven from their homes and villages, their property confiscated, 15,000 killed. When Lod became part of Israel, its Palestinian residents were killed or exiled. Lod's now known as Lod. The city is home to Ben-Gurion Airport. The film examines Lod's history and also presents an alternate reality in which the residents were not expelled in 1948. This is the trailer.
This tree has lemons, oranges, and grenades. Every day they would throw something at us, and we kept it as a reminder of what we went through. I don't want to go through a second Nakba.
I am thousands of years old. Everything changes. I'm not saying I want to be a utopia, a perfect city. I just want my exile sons and daughters back. I want to prosper again. The story of Lid is the story of Palestine.
The trailer for the new sci-fi documentary feature film Lid. On Friday, I spoke to Palestinian writer and activist Rami Younis, who's co-director of Lid. He's originally from Lid. We also were joined by his co-director, Sarah Emma Friedland. I began by asking Rami to talk about Lid and why he made the sci-fi documentary.
Lid was occupied in 1948. It was the city that once connected Palestine to the world. It had the Palestinian International Airport there, also due to its geographical location. It was a very important Palestinian bustling city. And then the occupation happened, and the city was almost completely demolished. And unfortunately, the story of that place hasn't been fully told. So we decided to tell it. However, how do you tell a story that's been told so many times before? I mean, it's the story of the Nakba, essentially. So we wanted to have a special twist. We wanted to do something that's a bit outside the box. And we figured, okay, let's imagine an alternate reality in which that occupation and the atrocities of 1948 never happened in that place. I mean, how would the reality be like if it weren't for these atrocities? So we decided to go a bit crazy and do something that's a bit unusual in the Palestinian film landscape. And fortunately, I had a co-director that believed in the same idea, and we clicked, and there we are, having our New York premiere.
I want to turn to a scene from the film Lid with city planner Orwa Svitat.
In Lid, as opposed to Haifa, Acre, or Jaffa, history was completely erased. They used bulldozers and tractors to completely clear the historic Palestinian structures. The Israeli planning policy from the occupation of 1948 to this day erases historic Palestinian space and imposes their own history of this place, starting with the important historical moment, which isn't called the 1948 occupation of Lid. It's called the 1948 liberation of Lid. The entire Zionist narrative does not only exist in private, but also in public space. As a Palestinian, you can walk around your neighborhoods and see that the street you live on is called Israeli Army Street. The roundabout that you drive through is called Palmach, where the massacre happened in 1948. Names in public space, landmarks, these symbols deliver a clear message to us, Palestinians, natives of this land, that this is not our land. You are not indigenous to this land. You are not owners of your home. Homeland, you are visitors.
Sarah Emma Friedland, talk about that massacre that he's referring to in 1948. And tell us where Lid is.
So Lid is the present-day city of Lod in Israel. It's 15 kilometers from Tel Aviv. It's where Ben-Gurion Airport is now. During historical Palestine, as Rami said, it was the city that connected Palestine to the world. But now it is devastated and disinvested and divided by the Israeli occupation. So the massacre that happened in 1948 happened in a central mosque in Lid called the Hamash Mosque. Lid was one of the last cities to fall during the Nakba. There were like 50,000 people in Lid in that moment because lots of people from different towns that had already been conquered by the Israeli state had come to Lid and were defending the city. And so when the Palmach soldiers came in, there was a lot of resistance in Lid. And some of this resistance was coming from the Hamash Mosque. But there were also civilians, women, children, men, everybody in the mosque. And so the Israeli soldiers, the Palmach soldiers.
And why are they called Palmach?
So Palmach is one of the brigades, the kind of militias that was pre-Israeli occupation forces before the State of Israel that was founded. And so these different militias during the Nakba were responsible for conquering many, many different towns and cities throughout historic Palestine. So when they came to Lid, there were many different atrocities that were committed in Lid, but the one we focus on is in this mosque. And so a Palmach soldier fired a anti-tank missile into the mosque and killed around 200 people. Of course, we don't know because, you know, as we know, the records are kept by the people in power. And so this was a really devastating moment because when Lid fell, that was kind of
almost like a symbol of the end of the resistance. And so after that, there was an expulsion from Lyd where about 50,000 people were expelled from the city and 1,000 people were kept in Lyd in a ghetto by the Israeli state in order to keep the infrastructure of the city going.
I want to turn to the scene from the film Lyd, where the Nakba survivor, Issa Fanous, recounts being held captive by Israeli soldiers as a child.
I don't know.
This is me here. This is Samir al-Aboudi. He was with me. When the Israeli army took us to Damash Mosque to remove the dead bodies, the decomposed bodies smelled really bad. Dreadful. A week or two after the massacre, they took us in the Israeli army vehicles. Me, Samir Aboudi, Rashid Fanous, Khalil Abu Judub, Khalil al-Bele to Lyd. We weren't captives. We were children. Like me, maybe a little older. I was probably the youngest. They took us there, dropped us off. Take out the bodies. Pulling. The bodies were falling apart, rotted. The smell was horrendous. We'd take the bodies out, and Israeli soldiers would burn them. At the end of the day, they would drive us back home. They took us 2 days in a row.
A 1948 Nakba survivor, of course, 1948 is the time of the founding of the State of Israel, speaking about what happened in Lyd. And this is personal for you, Rami. This is your family. You had ancestors, you had relatives who survived and didn't survive 1948?
So, yeah, I'm a third generation of, Nakba survivors. Like Sarah said, only less than 1,000 Palestinians were allowed to remain in Lyd. And we use the story of Lyd to symbolize the story of the Nakba, the Palestinian Nakba, the demolition and expulsion of over 600 villages all across Palestine. So, in a way, the story of Lyd is the story of Palestine. And to us, working on this film, Sarah and I, when we were shooting, not just Issa Fanous, the person we just showed, who unfortunately has died before we were able to finish the film. So we're paying tribute to him by mentioning his name and showing this clip. So filming this, filming them, was also our way of documenting what happened in 1948 for the ages, because we want to show that what happened in the past, still affecting what's happening mm-hmm. today. And what happened in the past, what started in the past in 1948 is still ongoing. So by telling these stories of these people, by documenting them, by capturing their accounts and showing them to people nowadays, maybe we're hoping people will get a wider perspective of what's happening in Israel, Palestine. And maybe that would be a kind and nice reminder that, unlike some people would like us to think, the world did not start on October 7th.
So let's go to this Palmach soldier. This is quite amazing. This is another scene with a member of Palmach, the Israeli militia group in 1948. But this is what, 1989. It's decades later when he is interviewed. And if you can set that up for us, Sarah, if you can set up why you have footage of a soldier from 1989 describing what he did mm-hmm. in 1948.
Yeah, so we were able to access this footage from the Palmach Military Archive in Israel. I had read about these clips, and Rami and I talked about it. And the Palmach, in 1989, decided to make a TV documentary about all of the battles that happened during 1948, all the invasions. And so they took these soldiers back to the places where they committed their war crimes, and they filmed with them. Because for the State of Israel, this is not anything to be ashamed of.
They are
proud of this history, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. So,
but this is one soldier mm-hmm. who wasn't proud.
I want to describe what I saw inside the mosque. There were women, men, and children in there. Some, a few, were injured, and I don't know from what. I don't know from what. A few were injured. Many were sitting against the wall, terrified, but looking at me. I remember that a small girl was sitting next to the wall, around 12 years old. She was holding her sister in her arms. She hugged her and was waving her other arm like a pendulum. With spread fingers, as if to say, "Don't shoot." And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know anything. I remember this sight and I stormed outside. Then, in front of the mosque's door, there was a wall, and in the corner sat a local Palestinian person. I remember his face. He had a round face. He was very injured. I don't know from what. That was the first time I was that close. And I saw his eyes, terrified, confused. I have no words. I was confused, but it appeared that in his eyes, I was the murderer. That's what he saw in my eyes. Then he looks at me and says in Yiddish, Obrachmones, meaning in Hebrew, have mercy on me. It reminded me of everything that we faced in exile, the pleas of mercy from Jews throughout generations, and I stormed outside, and I don't know what happened inside of the mosque afterwards.
That was a Palmach soldier recounting what he did in 1989, back in 1948. Rami Yunus, as you watch this, your thoughts. He is no longer alive.
As a Palestinian watching these, you know, soldiers describing what happened in, before that, and if you watch the film, you see other soldiers who are actually proud of what they did. I mean, they, you know, they look at the filmmakers, they look at the camera, and they describe how they fired an anti-tank missile into a mosque and then went in with a grenade, and one of the soldiers even said and what the anti-tank missile didn't take care of, the grenades took care of after that. So it's like they're as if it's a game to them, as if they're not killing human beings, and this is the danger of allowing them to keep doing that. And we need to keep talking about that, and we need to show that what happened in 1948 is still happening.
And what is the state of Lid today?
Not good. We have a population of around 30,000 Palestinians there, and if you come and see the city, if you have a tour in the city, you will see a stark differences between how Jewish people live there, Jewish Israelis live there, and how Palestinian citizens of Israel live in Lid. Poverty, it's a city infested with crime. Almost every week there are a few murders, unfortunately, and we've all been a victim of this crime, and police are not doing anything about it, as you can imagine.
So Palestinian writer and activist Rami Yunus, co-director of Lid, originally from the city of Lid. We were also joined by his co-director, Sarah Emma Friedland. You can watch our full-length interview with them at democracynow.org. Lid is currently playing at the DC TV Firehouse Cinema in New York, showings followed by Q&A with the filmmakers. The film will also be shown around the country and around the world, including the Houston Palestine Film Festival next month, the Chicago Palestine Film Festival, at the Lemley Theater in Los Angeles, and Unseen Cinema in Nairobi, Kenya. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Shrifa Bokadous, Messiah Rhodes, Nermin Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Malkoff, Tamaria Studio, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Hannah Lelius. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Osbeck. I'm Amy Goodman for another edition of Democracy Now!